Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Leading Ideas Talks is also brought to you by Protect, Sustain, Grow, best practices for handling your church's money. Whether it's your first time dealing with church finances or you've been handling them for years, this video toolkit will help you provide financial integrity and sustainability for your church, plus expand your church's income. Learn more and watch an introductory video at churchleadership.com/shop. Is a lack of resources limiting the potential of your ministry? In this episode, we speak with Sydney Williams of Crossing Capital about how congregations can develop new sources of capital in the marketplace, engage community partners, and develop unrecognized sources of social, intellectual, and human capital within the pews.
Hi, I'm Ann Michael. I'm the Associate Director of the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary, and I'm editor of Leading Ideas e-newsletter. And I'm pleased today to be the host for this episode of Leading Ideas Talks. I'm talking today with Reverend Dr. Sydney Williams, Jr., who's president and CEO of Crossing Capital Group, which works with churches to improve their sustainability. He's the author of the book Fishing Differently, Ministry Formation in the Marketplace. He's a graduate of Wesley Theological Seminary, ordained in the AME Church, and comes to his current ministry with a background in venture capital. So welcome, Sydney.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, and I'm glad to be in conversation with you today.
Good. I wondered if you could begin by saying just a few words about the work that you do so that our listeners will know where you're coming from on this.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I'm a graduate of Wesley Seminary, and when I was a student there, Dr. Weems was very inspirational. I walked away from Wesley with my MDiv wondering what the next faithful step would be as a pastor, as a seminary graduate. But one of the perplexing questions that was sort of gnawing at me is, how do we make sense of empowering congregations and communities when congregations are under-resourced and the members of those congregations are either unemployed or underemployed and yet wanting to do the work of God in their community, in their church? And so I saw there was a gap of a will to work, but essentially limited resources to take care of their own families and to do the work assigned to them in their churches. So this work, Fishing Differently, comes out of that question of trying to understand how congregations can begin to fish differently and not only have sustainability for their church, but more importantly, how to do the work, kingdom building work in their communities.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the challenge of churches being under-resourced. I imagine you work with a range of different kind of congregations. So what kinds of challenges and trends are you seeing with regard to congregations and their need to resource their ministry?
One of the things that when I was a student at Wesley, I was made aware of in congregations is sort of a gap of ideas. Oftentimes, the lay persons within congregations come not always with financial resources, but a wealth of ideas to empower the congregation to do the work of ministry. But sometimes there's a unwillingness or an unpreparedness to listen to the stories of the persons in these congregations. And so as Dr. Weems always talks about the next faithful step, I think sometimes pastors are a bit anxious about what that next step is. And rather than listening to the stories and assessing the wealth of ideas within congregations, we tend to rush into projects and programs without sufficient resources without the engagement of the congregation. And so it exacerbates an already under-resourced congregation. And then it frustrates the pastor, and then there's turnover. And so I saw that there were frustration both from the congregation and the pastor, and wanting to do the work and trying to execute the work.
Okay. So I read a lot in the area of stewardship and finance, and some of the most provocative writers on the subject of church finance today, yourself included, I would say, are saying that we are rapidly approaching the day when churches can no longer rely on tithes and offerings, or what you call faith capital, to support their ministry. And I guess I wanted to ask the question, how true do you think that is across the board? Because I know that there's a category, perhaps, of struggling congregations that are really needing to think differently, but looking across the board at congregations more generally, do you think we're coming to a tipping point when tithes and offerings are no longer going to be sufficient to support the ministry of all churches?
Well, that's a great question, and if I could, I'd reframe it. I think that the premise that congregations should be exclusively or predominantly supported by tithes and offering only favors wealthy congregations. I think that there is substantial life and viability in lower wealth congregations as well. When we contemplate when to close congregations, you know, we often look at their ability to sustain themselves in tithes and offering and then make a decision whether or not that congregation is viable. But I challenge that thinking because oftentimes that congregation has a wealth of ideas and sometimes physical assets, the actual property that that church owns is a untapped resource. And so, yes, if by all means, if a church has individuals who have sufficient disposable income to support the church, by all means, tithes and offerings are sufficient. But in most cases, in some of the most desperate places where we have churches and congregations, income may not be the resource, but it may be physical assets and definitely intellectual capital abounds within the church and within the community.
Yeah, so in your book, you talk about four different sources of capital that are available to churches. So can you quickly name those for the benefit of our listeners?
Yeah, so what nearly all churches rely on is the giving by faith of members and visitors, and we call that faith capital. But then I think the most underutilized, the most unappreciated is the intellectual capital that's sitting in the pews of congregations. I recall in the years I worked on Wall Street, I would go to churches, I would join churches. No one ever really asked me what I did or invited me to share my ideas or creativity and ways in which I could help that congregation. The only message I heard was give 10% and come to Bible study and go to Sunday school and we'll see you next Sunday. But I think there are many people that enter the doors of churches throughout this country and throughout the world, and we have to find a better way to tap into the intellectual capital, or what Deuteronomy refers to as the dunamis power, to create wealth. Secondly, Robert Putnam and others talk about social capital. Many churches are kind of enclaves or refuges unto themselves, not realizing there's a wealth of resources in the greater community. And we challenge church leaders to tap into that wealth of resources. They may not share your doctrine, they may not even be Christian, but they may share your heart or your mission for that community. And so we encourage people to build bridges with people outside of their congregation to see what things that they can do together, whether it's feeding the homeless, whether it's taking care of the needs of seniors, or whether it's meeting educational achievement gaps. There are a host of people that are willing to volunteer to invest in mission, but not necessarily become members.
So this would be engaging community partners to support the mission and missional initiatives of a congregation.
Exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, you know, it's the H, which stands for human capital, which is, you know, we tell people when they join our churches or that our church exists to improve the lives of people who worship with us and who are in community with us. But how do we measure that? How do we know we're actually getting the work done? And so I think our challenge to churches is, you know, how do you measure human capital? How are people getting better employment opportunities as a result of your ministry? How are people learning how to deal with conflict resolution? How are people just faring better as a result of our ministries and the work we do in community?
I'm still thinking about what you said about the adequacy of tithes and offerings in congregations, and we see congregations across the spectrum here in our work at the Lewis Center, and I think what we know from our own work and what we know from research is that just because a congregation may not be full of struggling people, in fact, a congregation might be full of quite affluent people, but that doesn't mean that they're good givers. there are plenty of congregations, I think, even that serve in affluent areas who are concerned about the adequacy of their faith capital just because people are far less spiritually prepared and inclined to give in the way that their predecessors in the faith did. And so I don't think this is a challenge just for under-resourced struggling congregations. I think this is a question for every congregation.
I thank you for that. I think it is worth teaching the importance of stewardship. When we do our training with churches, we start with a question: what does it mean to you to give to God? And I'm always surprised at the responses we get, because for some people, we assume giving to God means giving to the church. For many, giving to God is about charity, not obligation, certainly not tithes. And so there really is a diverse understanding of what does it mean to give to God. And so I think it's important to have missional conversations around, you know, what pleases God in the way of ministry and mission, and not presume that because people are a member of a church that they're going to automatically give to the church. I think people need clarity as to how their giving has a direct impact on mission and ministry. And then we talk about how that compares to charitable giving for nonprofit organizations. Most successful nonprofits are pretty clear about mission and impact and how every dollar they receive goes towards that. I think churches could do a better job of communicating to its members its mission, its ministry, its impact, and how giving connects to that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, both on the point that congregations need to be far more intentional about teaching the normative expectations of the faith with regard to giving. I think in congregations across the board, we take for granted that people understand why they give to the church and need to be doing a better job. But I think your point about telling the story of what giving does is also a critical piece as well. So I think that, you know, what you're saying, or what I'm hearing you saying, is that we are not going to abandon tithes and offerings. We're not going to not continue to invite people to give in accordance with the standards of the faith, but we're just also going to be thinking more holistically and creatively about other ways of resourcing ministry.
Correct. Yes, you nailed it.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you another question. I was intrigued by the subtitle of your book, which says, Ministry Formation in the Marketplace. What do you mean by that, ministry formation in the marketplace?
Sure. So oftentimes we think about, we formulate ministries within church councils or church meetings, but we really don't give thought to what's already happening in the marketplace. For example, some years ago we started I'll give the context, and we mentioned this in the book. Our church flooded in 2011. We had no flood insurance. And we needed to think through how we were going to get our church renovated in a way that would allow us to continue doing ministry, but more than that, how we could achieve our goals to have an impact on the community. As we researched the needs of the marketplace or of the larger community, we realized that the homeless, those who are asset limited or income limited, needed a place to have dinner on a regular basis, because so many people in our community, although they work full time, food insecurity is a significant problem in our community. And so rather than simply saying, let's see who can donate food so we could provide a meal once a month or once a week, we put a plan together that said if we could raise $1.5 million from the marketplace, we would provide dinners Monday through Friday, 52 weeks out of the year. And within about 6 to 8 months, we were able to achieve our fundraising goal of $1.5 million. We completed the renovations within 2 years. And for the last 7 years, we have now operated our community soup kitchen we call Table of Hope, 52 weeks out of every year, 5 days a week. We've never missed a day. And that's because we continue to engage the marketplace in this ministry. So it's not limited to the resource of the congregation. It's not limited to the resources of members who give food, but rather we engage the larger community. And so it's been a great ministry, very impactful. But that ministry was formed within the context of the marketplace, not within the meeting hall of the church.
Hmm. Well, I'm so glad that you shared that example, because I think it's what it points to is that these types of strategies, while it was successful in attracting the revenue that your church needed, it was also a way to expand your ministry footprint, create new partnerships, be more present in your community, meet needs. And so it really wasn't just a financial strategy. It was something more than that, right?
Yeah, and that's why we say it's ministry formation, right? It's not right. Just how do we have another fundraiser, but how do we think about ministry in a broader context?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, do you have some other examples with congregations that you worked with of how they've learned to fish differently and what kind of results you've seen?
Sure. And I would argue that our best hope in many cases is to get congregations to want to begin fishing differently. Mm. This process is not something that happens overnight. It's a 5 to 7 year process in many cases, because people are generally resistant to fish differently. They want to do things differently, but to actually do it is a real challenge. And so, we thus far have spent most of our energy getting churches to realize that they have to do something differently and then giving them a pathway to do it.
Mm-hmm.
We are now in the process of Crossing Capital of putting together a capacity building grant so that we can go beyond a 1 or 2 day training session to a multi-year training session. And so hopefully with our partners, we can fund a multi-year capacity building effort for churches and congregations to be able to really begin fishing differently.
Yeah. I'm not surprised that it's a long process to get a congregation to begin to think outside the box, if you will, about this. What are some of the different attitudes and competencies that a congregation needs to develop if it's going to learn to swim in this bigger ocean, if you will?
Yeah, I think Dale Andrews, or late Dale Andrews, sort of talks about the refuse paradigm, or what I think Lovett Weems refers to social clubs, where churches tend to be more inwardly focused.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the first hurdles is for congregations to become outwardly focused,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, can be disruptive and discomforting for some. And then I think among leaders, it requires a level of emotional intelligence, because churches not only are inwardly focused oftentimes, but they also tend to want people to conform to a particular ethos or pathos and how they think about the faith. And I think we have to be more accepting, more embracing of different truths, different ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to engage multiple generations and really begin to sort of open up the windows, if you will, for diverse thinking and creativity. And this is the real work.
Yeah.
Because churches are still splitting and dividing because we don't want to accept difference. We don't want to accept different worldviews within the life of the congregation. And yet I think that is so fundamental to the work of Fishing Differently.
It seems to me like one of the first things a congregation needs to do if they're going to walk down this road is enlarge their imagination. I mean, yes. I think congregations are so used to, you know, a certain way of doing things and a certain way of thinking about things, a certain way of thinking about just how they're going to operate and engage. And this is really an invitation to think very differently about how a church is going to exist in relation to the world. And so it seems like it's a mindset shift that they almost have to be introduced to some of the possibilities and in order to develop the creative imagination to think differently about how they could be. I'm thinking there's kind of a vision casting piece in this.
Yeah, and we begin the journey because this is, as I said before, it's a difficult invitation, but we begin the invitation with storytelling.
Okay.
You know, and it's a timeless tradition, but it's also probably the least practiced. In our society today, there was a time when we would gather at the dinner table and share stories of the day. I remember growing up, just spending time with my grandparents, listening to their stories of their childhood and their family journey, and then sharing that with my children. I think we've lost some of that in our churches today. And so we begin that journey with the power of storytelling. And I love it when those who have been in the church 30, 40, 50 years share the story of how they got to where they are today. And in those stories, we find what Walter Brueggemann calls a prophetic imagination. We rediscover wells of hope that if God has done this for this congregation before, God can do it again.
Hmm.
And I think sometimes even our seniors forget the stories.
Right.
And so inviting them to share those stories of maybe how they move from one location to another, of how they found the resources to build the current edifice. Those stories empower future generations to do likewise.
Mm-hmm.
And it begins to build bridges. And then we do something else, and we encourage pastors to do this, is to celebrate the faithful members who've been on this journey. Because sometimes those seniors don't feel celebrated. They feel pushed aside. Their stories are forgotten. The things they may have done 50 years ago to help the church over troubled waters, those stories have been forgotten.
Mm.
And so we invite them into a reflection so that as they begin to reflect, they can now have this prophetic imagination of what could be.
So the seeds of this new imagination, this new vision, are deeply rooted in the collective memories of the church. And I so much appreciate you sharing that, because I wasn't necessarily thinking of that as a first step in this direction. But what other steps do you are typical as a congregation begins to think about this? I mean, is there an assessment stage where you take stock of what's present in the congregation and in the community?
Yeah, so we have a leadership assessment we've developed to really get a sense of the orientation. There are some leaders who are very autocratic, top-down, and it would take an act of God to change them. They are probably not suitable candidates for fishing differently. There are some congregations who are in the midst of a very toxic battle and just trying to reconcile past hurts. They may be great candidates for fishing differently, but the problems may be too acute or too near to begin this healing process. So we do assess kind of where the congregation is, where the leaders are. Are they ready to begin the journey? We named our company Crossing Capital based on this experience of the Hebrews when they left Egypt. You'll remember that, shortly after they left Egypt, they desired to go back to Egypt. And so they weren't ready to cross over because they were still traumatized from the journey, traumatized through going through the Red Sea experience. And they just wanted to go back to safety, at least their perceived safety in Egypt. And sometimes congregations have been through too much trauma to even begin to hope. It hurts to hope. And so we assess where that congregation is in the journey. And we really like to find congregations that have been through that wilderness journey and are now contemplating what the future looks like. And then we help them, if you'll remember, as they get to the promised land, they still see themselves as grasshoppers. But they're at the precipice. And so it's how do we get those congregations that see themselves as grasshoppers to imagine what God has in store for them if they would only take the next step?
So there's some readiness factors, including really, I think what you're describing is spiritual readiness to see a new way, see new possibilities.
If I could add, it's both spiritual, emotional,
okay,
and intellectual.
Okay,
right. It's a heart, mind, and spirit journey because. It's hard for people to imagine something they've never seen. And so people have to get pretty close to what it is they want before we can help them cross over. I've met some pastors who, are close to retirement. And fishing differently is not something they want to do.
Okay, fair enough.
I've met pastors who literally are at the brink of burnout and are contemplating if they even want to be in ministry going forward. So assessing where the leadership is, what the congregation has been through recently. I mean, I think those are important first steps before we start talking about engaging the marketplace and social impact. If people are hurting, we've got to deal with that first.
Yeah. Thank you. That's extremely helpful. As we begin to draw this to a close, I wonder if you can share a word of hope, really, because I think so many congregations do feel in a place of limitation and constraint. They know that the way they've always done things isn't necessarily sufficient anymore, and yet they don't, not sure. I may not see all these new possibilities. What word of hope would you offer to congregations that maybe are just beginning to perceive the need to fish differently?
I'm reminded of my time at Wesley when we went on our first mission trip to Uganda. And at the conclusion of our time in Uganda, which is where I got the idea of fishing differently, I was overwhelmed with sadness because I thought we needed more time in Uganda. There was just so much more work to do. And I remember Professor Fred Smith, who was our leader on that trip, said that we have done our part. but God will send others. Hmm. And so he reminded us that one plants, another waters, and God gives the increase. For so many of our congregations, the anxiety comes because we want to take it to the next step. And maybe our journey simply is to hand it off to the next generation or the next leaders to come. And so I think trusting God that if God has started it, God will finish it. That, you know, it's God that does the work, not us.
Yeah.
And trusting in God's providence to lead our congregations to the next level.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's a very good word. Yeah, very, very true, but very important, I think, for everybody to keep in mind, because so often, I think particularly in this area of finances where we tend to bring the world's logic into the way we think about church, it's very easy for us to lose track of the fact that we need to let go and let God, as people
yes.
say. Yeah.
There's some truth in that.
Yeah. So, Sydney, I want to thank you for the work that you're doing, for the resources that you've provided through your book. Thank you for talking with us today.
On the next Leading Ideas Talks, we discuss discipleship and developing disciples with Kay Cotan, the director for the Center for Multiplying Disciples in the Arkansas Annual Conference of the United Methodist Church.
And I just find it so fascinating that we as churches are, that's our business. We're in the disciple-making business, but a great majority of the churches, that, or at least in my experience that I have worked with across our great nation, have no intentional process or system to do disciple-making. And I think we relied on our church-centric world and our curriculum-driven learning for decades now, and we're now in a place where we have generations of people who have been sitting in the pews with this kind of discipling or lack thereof for 20, 30, maybe even 50 years, who are not disciples. They've been attenders, but they haven't moved in their discipleship. They haven't been discipled by others, but they wouldn't even realize this. And probably those around them may not even realize that they're not disciples.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.